Welcome back to another episode of the Chronic Fatigue and Burnout Recovery Podcast. It has been a while since I have recorded a podcast, although I always say you probably don't notice because the podcasts are pre-recorded and scheduled out. So, you know, they're constantly arriving in your app or wherever you listen to them. But for me, recording them, it has been a little bit of time. In February, I think it was February, I made the decision just to drop down the publications to every other week instead of weekly. For a few reasons, mostly just time. I've just had a very, very busy start to the year with client work, and there just hasn't been a lot of time at the end of the week or the end of the day for doing the preparation that's sometimes required to record episodes, to even think about what episodes I'm going to record, let alone find guests, that sort of thing. So just in terms of helping me manage my own workload and have a bit of a life also outside of work, I decided to drop the episodes down to every other week. But there are so many episodes on this podcast. So even if you are new to the podcast, or even if you've listened to all the episodes, there's so much information here that's probably, you know, not even all actionable all in one go. So I hope even with the reduced publishing schedule that you are still getting huge benefits from the podcast. And sometimes, especially if there's a few good ones that can come quite close together, having a weekly episode doesn't always give you the time if there's things that you maybe want to think about or go away and implement after listening to the episode. We need time and space to make changes. So there's always more work that we could be doing on our health, and, you know, having less information coming at us all the time sometimes just gives the space to put some things into practice. So I am getting back into my recordings, and today I'm going to be talking about oxalates, specifically how oxalates could be impacting your energy or your health in general as part of this fatigue recovery journey. And so oxalates are something I've been, it's really funny, like with clients, like I haven't had a lot of clients who have oxalate issues, but then they're like buses and they all come at once. And just recently I've been having conversations with a lot of clients about oxalates. It's something that I've explored myself in my own journey. I'll share some personal anecdotes in this podcast. And I thought, okay, I'm talking about this all the time with clients. It really is something I should do an episode on. So that's what we're going to be looking at today. And we'll be looking at what oxalates are, how do you know if they are a problem for you, and then if they are a problem for you, most importantly, what can you do to address them, and just how long do you need to potentially follow a low oxalate diet for, some practicalities and things to consider if that's something that you're going to pursue. And then I'll share some personal experience as well working with oxalates. So that's what you can expect from this episode. As always, if you haven't already, I would really appreciate it if you could leave a review. Every week I check the Spotify app and I can see the reviews just going up, like even sometimes one at a time, two at a time. But it's always nice to see when people are leaving reviews. You can just give 5 stars on Spotify, or you can give 5 stars on iTunes. You can also write a little blurb on iTunes if you feel like it. And I would be so grateful because it does help improve the podcast rankings and it does help other people find this information, which in some cases can be absolutely life-changing for them. So if you haven't already done that, take a moment now to do that. And then we will talk about oxalates. So let's first of all start off by saying that energy-limiting illnesses, shall we call them, are often complex, often misunderstood, and often just leave people struggling with fatigue, brain fog, muscle aches, chronic pain, multiple different symptoms as well. And although there are so many different factors that can contribute to symptoms, and every case is different, I don't have 2 clients who are exactly the same, diet can play a significant role in the management of symptoms. And then there are so many different dietary approaches. You've probably heard me talk about them already on this podcast. Things like the ketogenic diet, or a low histamine diet, or a paleo diet, or an autoimmune paleo diet, or a low FODMAP diet. And, you know, the list goes on and on and on. But one of the possible diets that can help with symptom management in the case of energy limiting illnesses is a low oxalate diet. So today we're going to talk a little bit about the relationship between oxalates and chronic fatigue, the possible causes of oxalate intolerance, and how you can adjust your oxalate intake to help alleviate some of the challenging symptoms that you might be experiencing as a result of whatever health condition you present with, whether you have a diagnosis or not. But let's first of all start off talking about what are oxalates. So oxalates are naturally occurring compounds that we find in plant-based foods such as spinach or rhubarb or certain nuts and seeds. Chemically, they are salts or esters of oxalic acid. And in the body, oxalates can bind with minerals such as calcium, but also magnesium, potassium, zinc, and iron to form insoluble compounds. For example, the most commonly known is calcium oxalate, which is a common cause of kidney stones. However, kidney stones are not the only ailment associated with oxalates. Once oxalates are bound to minerals, they form an insoluble precipitate, which is basically described as a crystal or a shard of glass. And these shards of glass are potentially circulated around the body, and then they become deposited in tissue and also organs, and they can cause a lot of damage. They are very inflammatory, they are very toxic, and some of the damage can also impact our mitochondria, which is the potential link between oxalates and energy. And also the fact that they're highly toxic and highly inflammatory can also impact energy. And so because they are highly toxic and inflammatory, it is thought that the damage created by these oxalate crystals can contribute to symptoms, many of which are associated with chronic fatigue and other energy-limiting illnesses. And there is evidence that many, many different symptoms and conditions could be associated with oxalate intolerance, although there can be other causes for these conditions which are independent of oxalates as well. So just keep that in mind. But I have a whole list here which I want to read to you, but it will potentially be very boring. So I'll just pick out some of the main ones that I see with people that I'm working with, which is asthma, autoimmunity, burning mouth, candida overgrowth, chronic infections, electrolyte deficiencies, endometriosis, eye pain and eye burning, fatigue and fibromyalgia, irritable bowel disease or irritable bowel syndrome, joint and muscle pain, leaky gut, mast cell activation syndrome, migraine, mineral deficiencies, neurological symptoms, nutrient deficiencies, PCOS, reflux, sandy stools, sleep disorders, thyroid dysfunction, uterine fibroids, and white spots on the skin. So I've read probably about half of the conditions on my list. So there are more conditions. I also have this list on my blog if you want to find it. I'll potentially link it with the show notes. And you can read about all the different conditions that have some research to show that they could be linked with oxalates. Obviously, remembering that some of these conditions could also not be linked with oxalates. So we always need to look at each individual case and then determine if oxalates are something worth pursuing or not. Because many people do not find oxalates problematic, but some people can have oxalate intolerance, which is when the amount of oxalate in the body is too much for them to handle, and then that can present in certain symptomology as discussed. So how do you know if oxalates are a problem for you? That's probably the next question that you want the answer to. Well, first of all, it's important to mention that there are no reliable tests per se for oxalate intolerance. And therefore, one of the best ways to know if it's a problem for you is to slowly reduce your oxalate intake and then see if you feel better. The only challenge with this is it's a big commitment. You probably want to eat a low oxalate diet for a significant amount of time, probably about 6 months. And as we get more into today's episode, I'll talk a little bit about some of the ups and downs with reducing oxalates and oxalate dumping, which means that even when you reduce oxalates, sometimes you can still flare and feel worse, which makes it quite a complicated complicated diet to follow, I guess, different to some of the other diets where maybe, like, for example, if you give up gluten or you give up dairy, you just give it up and then you can tell in a short space of time if it's helping or not. Oxalates are a little bit different. So it often requires the individual to be committed to pursue a low oxalate diet. And therefore, some people don't really want to make these dietary changes if they don't necessarily know they have to. But if you feel like you've explored a lot of different options and you're not feeling better, it might be the thing that can really make the difference for you. So that's worth keeping in mind. That being said, organic acids testing, which is urine testing, such as the OAT test by Mosaic Diagnostics or Organics, which is by Genova Diagnostic, do have urine markers for oxalates. So these tests will test glycolic acid, glyceric acid, and oxalic acid. And an elevation in all or any of these markers can suggest an oxalate issue. So although I said that there was no reliable testing for oxalate intolerance, that doesn't mean we can't test oxalates. We can. And if you have elevated urine oxalates, you may want to consider pursuing a low oxalate diet or exploring the issue further. But even if you test normal on urine testing, it doesn't necessarily rule the issue out for you, because sometimes oxalates can clear in fits and starts from the body. And that means if you're doing a single morning urine test, you may not capture the oxalates at that point in time. And in some cases, collecting urine over 6 hours versus just a single morning urine sample collection can possibly capture more oxalates than otherwise. So we do have some tests, but what I want you to take away from this is that even if the tests are negative, it doesn't necessarily rule this out as a problem for you. And that was my experience. I have done probably at least 5 different organic acid tests over my time, and I've never had elevated urinary oxalates. But when I started to reduce my oxalate consumption, I started to notice some pretty profound things, which I'll share with you more towards the end of the episode. But let's just say you did test and you did have high urinary oxalates. How do you go about addressing this? What do you do next? So to address oxalates, we want to address possible triggers, and I'll discuss what those triggers are in a moment. We also need to stop or slow down the input. And so this is the oxalates we're putting into our body from diet. And then we also want to support the breakdown and elimination of oxalates in the body. This is to support clearance so that those little shards of glass can get out of our tissues and stop causing damage, toxicity, and inflammation. But let's first talk about the triggers. So common oxalate triggers could be dysbiosis or imbalances in the gut bacteria. So a disruption in the balance of gut bacteria can lead to higher oxalate absorption. And certain bacteria in the gut, for example, the Oxalobacter formigenes, can help break down oxalates. So when these bacteria are low or out of balance, oxalates are broken down less efficiently, and therefore they can accumulate in the body. So we can test for Oxalobacter formigenes in the GIFX stool test by Genova, which is the stool test I use with a lot of my clients for this exact reason, not the only reason, but one of the reasons. They do have a marker for Oxalobacter formigenes. And again, if I'm seeing no or low Oxalobacter in the stool test and then elevated urinary oxalates, we know there's an oxalate issue. But in my own experience, I had high levels of Oxalobacter and low levels of urinary oxalates, and yet oxalates were still something that I had to look at and address. There are also some other species which can be associated with oxalate issues, the B. bifido animalis and L. lactobacillus animalis have also been implicated. Unfortunately, there's no test at the moment which tests these species and then the Oxalobacter. I think there's a US test, which is the gut Zuma test. So if you're US based, you could test the B. animalis and the L. animalis, and that's through the Gutzuma. But here in the UK, I think we need to import Gutzuma from the US, and therefore it's really expensive. So I tend not to use that one with clients. I prefer to use the GIFX. So linked with digestive health is also intestinal permeability, colloquially called leaky gut syndrome. If the gut is more leaky and you're not degrading your oxalates well, then more are going to potentially pass through into the bloodstream. And this is going to be an extra burden on the body, whether that's your organs, whether that's the kidneys, whether that's the mitochondria. It just increases the total body burden. Then we also have candida overgrowth. I have previously done a whole episode on candida, so that is something you can also go and listen to. But candida may contribute to higher oxalate production in the gut. And in some cases, candida may produce oxalates as a byproduct of its own metabolism. So basically, candida is creating more oxalates and impacting the degradation. And this is particularly relevant to those people if they've got compromised gut membrane integrity, so leaky gut, where more oxalates are being absorbed into the bloodstream, and then they're not being broken down properly. The candida is just an extra load on top of that load. The same goes for mold. So inflammation from mold producing mycotoxins can lead to increased oxalate production and poor oxalate metabolism. So similar to candida, and this can increase the overall oxalate burden of the body. So often people with oxalate issues have mold, have candida, have gut infections, and possibly also have compromised gut membrane integrity. So it probably goes without saying at this point in time that we need to really support the gut if someone has an oxalate issue. Then we have obviously a high oxalate diet, and I will talk more about diet in more detail, but basically a diet which is high in oxalates may contribute to oxalate intolerance, especially when compounded by other things. So you've got your mold, you've got your bacteria, you've got your fungal overgrowth, you've got your leaky gut, and now you're eating lots of high oxalate foods. It's just compounding the issue. And sometimes, we can be eating a lot of these high oxalate foods that's perpetuating some of the inflammation, which is then making it more difficult to get these infections to clear. So sometimes, even though we maybe want to go in and address the infections, sometimes we actually have to reduce the oxalate burden on the body before those infections can actually be cleared. And so someone who's done a lot of research on this particular topic is Sally K. Norton. She has a website which is dedicated to oxalates. It's a great reference for anybody who's interested in this work. And she also has a book called Toxic Superfoods, which I think is a fantastic book. But she basically describes in this book that a diet which is over 600 milligrams of oxalates per day is extremely high. And if you love dark chocolate, if you love almond butter, if you are having almond milk lattes, you will very easily get up to 600 milligrams of oxalate per day. So it's easier done than what we think. So the other thing to be aware of is that lower levels of oxalates can still be problematic, even when other issues are there as well. So for example, you might not be eating 600 milligrams of oxalates per day, but if you're still eating 150 milligrams of oxalates per day, but you have all of these other issues going on, then you still may need to lower your dietary oxalate load. There's just a couple of other things here. So high vitamin C. Vitamin C can convert to oxalate in the body. I know some practitioners are a fan of high doses of vitamin C or even vitamin C IV. These can be great for certain people, but if there's an oxalate issue, we have to be really, really cautious. So vitamin C is essential, but excessive amounts can lead to an increase in oxalate production. And high doses of vitamin C can even contribute to kidney stone formation in people who are susceptible. Then we have mitochondrial dysfunction. So this is like the catch-22, right? If we have an oxalate overload, that could be damaging to the mitochondria. But if the mitochondria are also compromised, this can also lead to an impact on oxalate production and cause overproduction of oxalates. And this is because the mitochondria are involved in various metabolic pathways, which include oxalate breakdown. Then we have nutrient deficiencies. We talked about we don't want to have excess vitamin C because that can be problematic, but nutrient deficiencies can also be problematic because oxalate intolerance can both exacerbate and create nutrient deficiencies. And some of the important nutrients to consider would be things like calcium and electrolytes like magnesium, potassium, and sodium. And a lot of people need electrolytes, and that could sometimes be a clue that there may be some underlying oxalate issues. For calcium specifically, calcium binds with oxalates to form calcium oxalate, which is usually excreted in the urine. So if we have low levels of calcium, then the body may absorb more oxalate and then we're storing more oxalate, which is adding to this total load of oxalate buildup in the body. Then we have vitamin K. Vitamin K is involved in calcium metabolism because it helps direct calcium into the bone. And if someone is vitamin K deficient, this can cause an increased binding of dietary and or supplemental calcium to oxalates, and that can increase risk of kidney stones. So it's this delicate balance where we want to make sure we've got enough calcium, but we also want to make sure we've got enough vitamin K. Then we have magnesium deficiency. Magnesium also helps to prevent oxalate buildup, and a lack of magnesium can exacerbate and affect high oxalate consumption. And then vitamin B6 deficiency, because vitamin B6 plays a crucial role in oxalate metabolism. Low levels of B6 can impair the body's ability to process oxalates, leading to increased oxalate production. So if oxalates are an issue for you, you may just want to check your calcium, check your vitamin K, think about magnesium, think about vitamin B6. Those are some of the nutrients that I am prioritizing with clients. And then I've said already that digestive support is going to be important. Oxalates are typically associated with digestive imbalances, as we've already discussed, and therefore supporting the gut will be part of the process. We talked about those particular bacteria. So for example, the Oxalobacter and the L and B animalis. Unfortunately, there's no supplement at the moment where you can supplement with those strains specifically, but there is some research to show that spore-based probiotics can be beneficial. So something like Megaspore, for example, could be a useful product. But I would probably go in, depending on the individual, with some sort of a combination product. I really like the Cellcore CT Biotic because it has lactobacillus, bifidobacterium, some spore-based organisms, and Saccharomyces boulardii. However, what I find with probiotics, especially if you're somebody who's histamine sensitive, you have to be a little bit careful which ones and which strains you're supplementing with, because I have had people flare just from taking probiotics. Then also the other consideration when it comes to digestive health is you want to address digestion of food and absorption of food. Because if we're not digesting food well, and then we have undigested food particles hanging around in the gut, then that's potentially fuel for dysbiotic bacteria. And then that can potentially also be the excess overgrowth of bacteria is damaging for the gut lining, and then we can end up with intestinal permeability. So how we go about supporting digestion and absorption really has to be done in a case-specific manner. Some people actually digest and absorb very well, and then some people struggle with protein digestion, some people struggle with fat digestion, some people struggle with their pancreatic enzyme production, some people struggle with all of it. So this is where stool testing can be really helpful to identify what specific imbalances each individual has and then how we can target those specifically. Or even just a good, if you don't have money for testing, even just like a good case history, looking at symptoms, things like that can be potentially helpful in sort of teasing out what's going on with someone from a digestion absorption capacity. And then we do need to address the overgrowth of bacteria, the overgrowth of mold, the overgrowth of yeast. We need to restore the lining of the gut. The challenge is that a lot of the supplements that do all of this, that support the gut lining and that can kill off excess bacteria, can also be high in oxalates. So we need to be careful in terms of the choices of supplements that we're making. And this is why reducing the dietary load of oxalates prior to starting an antimicrobial protocol can be really beneficial to improve overall tolerance. So that's a lot of different information. Let's talk about diet and specifically how to reduce your dietary oxalates and how to implement a low oxalate diet. And here I will say that often well-meaning, health-conscious people unintentionally switch to a high oxalate diet in an attempt to improve their health. They may eat dark chocolate because they want to reduce how much sugar they're having. They may give up cow's dairy because they think that dairy is bad for them, and then they switch to almond milk. They might be throwing handfuls of spinach into their morning smoothies, or they might be having turmeric and ginger shots for the anti-inflammatory benefits. And all of these foods are, you know, there's nothing wrong with them in their own right. But they're all high oxalate foods. And when you add up the cumulative load of all of these different foods, you may be easily consuming that 600 milligrams of oxalates per day that I previously mentioned. And so if you're someone who has always believed that an abundance of vegetables is good for you, and if you're like me and you love green tea and dark chocolate and salad, following a low oxalate diet is really going to challenge some of your belief systems about food. And that can be a really, really hard pill for people to swallow. Also, just naming that when people are fatigued, when they're unwell, they can't do a lot of things, you know, having to now make dietary changes and restrict your diet can take away more of the joy. And that can be, you know, quite challenging for people mentally. But if it improves your health, it can be worth it. I'll talk a little bit more about this as we move through the episode, but just to say that it's something that's worth doing if you're in this category of people where it makes sense to do, but you also have to take these things on when you have the emotional capacity for it. Because I have seen clients who really want to make dietary changes. They come with lots of positive intent, but food is so overcoupled with emotion. And food, changing your diet can be very stressful when you only have a certain emotional capacity. So we need to have enough emotional capacity for dietary change, and we need to make space in our lives for dietary change as well. So now that I've shared all of that with you, what I would say is that for somebody experiencing oxalate overload, a therapeutic diet may be around 60 milligrams of oxalates per day. So 60 milligrams of oxalates per day is less than 2 squares of 85% dark chocolate. So if you're someone like me who used to eat probably 5 squares of dark chocolate most days, 3 to 5, I'll give myself some grace. Now that's a really big adjustment. And so it's really important that you reduce your dietary oxalates slowly. When you lower your dietary oxalate load, this may encourage the system to excrete more stored oxalates, which can cause damage. You know, these shards of glass, shall we call them, if they're being mobilized and they're moving around the body for excretion, they can cause more damage on the way out. And this can cause a flare up in symptoms. They can activate mast cells. And this is what is referred to as oxalate dumping. And oxalate dumping can present in many ways. Often I say to clients to like look out for an increase in the symptoms which are familiar to them, but it can also show up as things like increased hunger, maybe headaches, nausea, fatigue, brain fog, increase in pain, whether that's musculoskeletal pain, flank pain, so pain above the kidneys, because obviously the kidneys are processing these oxalates, rectal pain, eye pain and pressure, rashes, vulva pain in women. High oxalate intake can be associated with a vulvodynia, which is like a neuropathic pain of the vulva in women, and then also kidney stones. So in some cases, oxalate dumping can be very dangerous, especially in those who are at risk of kidney stones. Therefore, the approach I use with clients when addressing oxalates is to ask them to, first of all, before they change anything, to get an understanding of what their baseline intake is. And there are various apps that you can use to look up how much oxalate is in your diet. And there are various resources available online. You can also check out Sally K. Norton's website. She has, and her book have got some great resources to help you understand like how much oxalate is in all the different foods that you're eating. So you have to do a little bit of homework, but it's definitely worth it. And also just important here to mention that there are no exact standards for the amounts of oxalate in foods. There are so many different factors which could contribute to how much oxalate is in food. And therefore, we only have a rough guide, but a rough guide is good enough. So once someone has their baseline, they've maybe for a week or a few days, they've added up their oxalate intake, then we usually recommend a slow reduction of 5 to 10% a week. So say you added up all your oxalates, you were having 500 grams on average a day, then to take that down by 5% might be you have 475 milligrams a day, or 10%, 450 milligrams a day. And then each week you could take it a little bit lower and a little bit lower. If someone is more sensitive, then I'd say, you know, maybe rather do the 5% versus the 10%. And it's really important to go slowly as needed and not to rush the process. And so if you experience any flares, such as the oxalate dumping, you can slow the process down by increasing your oxalate intake again a little bit. You could also do one day lower, one day higher, one day lower, one day higher. You could also reduce your intake every 2 weeks instead of weekly. If you tolerate it, I know some people with histamine issues don't always tolerate lemon, but a little bit of lemon juice mixed with water can help with the oxalate breakdown. Baking soda mixed with water can before meals can help to stabilize the mast cells, which are probably going to be getting triggered and hence causing the flare-ups and the oxalate dumping. And in some cases, again, if tolerated, using sauna or hot-cold contrast can be supportive just to help with the oxalate clearance from the body. And as I said already, is that sometimes as the oxalates are being processed out, their mast cell triggers. So if you are someone who has histamine issues or mast cell activation syndrome, you are potentially increasing your the triggers for your mast cells, and there could be some mast cell flare-up or histamine flare-up as this process is happening, in which case it can also be beneficial to reduce histamines in your diet. So I've never really followed a low histamine diet until I followed a low oxalate diet. And then I did the two together to manage flare-ups when I did this process myself. Obviously, we don't want you to eat nothing. So having done low oxalate and low histamine and low FODMAP all at once, I can tell you that it's not fun to have a very limited diet. So we really want to still maintain as much diversity as possible. And so in the initial stages of change, instead of just cutting out foods, it can be helpful to swap foods. So you're swapping higher oxalate foods for lower oxalate foods. And it goes beyond the scope of this podcast to do like a comprehensive list. But for example, we know spinach is really high in oxalates, but lettuce is really low. So if you're putting loads of spinach in a smoothie or a salad, you can have lettuce instead. Nuts, for example, almonds can be really high oxalate. I was eating lots of almond nut butter. But macadamia nuts or pistachios or seeds like pumpkin seeds can be a bit lower. So you can swap those in. Often people are drinking almond milk because they want to be dairy-free. So coconut, oat milk, or cow's dairy could be alternative options. A lot of people are told to eat berries because of the polyphenols, but raspberries and strawberries can be high oxalate, whereas blueberries are lower. Sweet potato, which a lot of people who are eating a paleo diet will maybe have a lot of sweet potato, or beetroot as well, can also be high oxalate. But butternut squash might be a lower oxalate food swap. If you're having brown rice, you can switch to white rice because a lot of the oxalate is going to be in that like outer shell of the rice. And if you're having dark chocolate, you could switch to white chocolate or vanilla ice cream. you do just have to be careful of the sugar. I mean, I, as I've said already, I love dark chocolate. I used to eat loads of dark chocolate, and you know, I dabbled with a bit of white chocolate, but I just found it too sweet. And I thought I'll rather just not have anything sweet than have white chocolate, to be honest. So you'll have to reconcile that with your blood sugar and your preferences to work that one out. So as you're working on this gradual lowering of oxalates, you could make one of these swaps, for example, a week. Take out the spinach, put in the lettuce. Then the next week, you're switching your almond milk for oat milk. Then the next week, you're switching your sweet potato for butternut squash. And then gradually over time, you're switching out some of these foods and just gently lowering the oxalate load of your diet. Then as we're doing this, we're also wanting to think about supplements. I've said that how we address the oxalate overload is by addressing the triggers, making sure that we're not putting fuel on the fire by consuming lots of oxalates, and then we need to support elimination and clearance. And this is where supplements can be beneficial, is this to support this elimination and clearance piece of the puzzle. The thing to be aware of just on the topic of supplements is that some supplements can be high oxalate. So for example, turmeric or curcumin, which is very popular from a managing inflammation standpoint, can be high oxalate. So when I'm working with clients with oxalate issues, I actually prefer less is more. I would say generally, the more I'm working with clients, I prefer less is more. I see a lot of people who are taking so many different products, and sometimes we do need to take a lot of things. But there's also a time to simplify and just really focus on a few core things, especially if oxalates are an issue. So I have already mentioned the importance of calcium and how that binds to oxalates. So that could be supplemented if someone's not having good amounts of dairy in their diet, but you will get good amounts of calcium in dairy products if you're eating them. Sodium, potassium, and magnesium can all be beneficial. Also, I like to recommend magnesium sulfate, so Epsom salts, because you're getting the magnesium and the sulfur, which can help with oxalate clearance. Sulfur, when it comes to sulfur, oxalate and sulfate share transporters, which means that oxalate moves through the body on sulfate transporters and binds to sulfate receptor sites. And this means that one will influence the other. And often people are low in sulfur, especially like someone like myself, where I followed a low FODMAP diet for so long that a lot of the sulfurous foods like onions and garlic and the brassica vegetables, I wasn't really eating any of those. So at one point in time, years ago now, I even did a low sulfur diet. And so, of course, a low sulfur diet and a low FODMAP diet in the short term can be very therapeutic. But we have to watch out for how sometimes these dietary approaches can create deficiencies longer term. So if we can increase sulfate, this can improve metabolism of stored oxalates. And obviously magnesium sulfate from the Epsom salt baths is just a really nice way to do that and also increase your self-care. And whenever I say to my clients, could you do more Epsom salt baths? They're, most of them, not necessarily all of them, but most of them like, yes, of course I can. So that's a really nice, easy and accessible thing for people to do. Then we've got citric acid. So citric acid is naturally occurring in fruits such as citrus fruits. I mentioned lemon earlier and berries as well. But it can also be taken in a chelated form with a supplement. So for example, potassium citrate, magnesium citrate, calcium citrate. And these are all the minerals and electrolytes that we're wanting to supplement anyway. So if we are taking potassium, magnesium, calcium, we can take citrate forms, and the citric acid can help to break down oxalates. However, citric acid can be problematic for some people, especially those who are histamine sensitive. So we have to be cautious with that recommendation. And then I also mentioned vitamin B6. So vitamin B6 plays a crucial role in oxalate metabolism, and therefore B6 can be supplemented or it can be taken as part of a B complex. Some people don't do well on B vitamins. So we do need to kind of adjust this on a case-by-case basis. If someone does tolerate B vitamins well, I would usually just recommend like a good B complex with good amounts of B6. But sometimes we just have to give the Bs individually building up over time until they can tolerate all of them, and then we can go towards a B complex. So how long do you need to follow this diet? Well, what I said already is that following a low oxalate diet is a long-term commitment. And I would say now it's not for the faint-hearted. I consider myself pretty resilient when it comes to dietary change. I've done so many different diets across my lifetime. Some, you know, a lot of different things for health reasons, but then also just a lot of self-experimentation. Being a practitioner, I feel it's really important that you try different things out so you know what your clients are going through when they have to do it. And I would say this is the hardest diet I've ever done. And for me to say that, that's a lot, because I'm usually just someone who gets on with things and I don't complain about it. So I would say that it is a long-term commitment. You have to be emotionally ready for it. And it's really important to know at the outset that it can take months and in some cases even years to lower one's oxalate load. It's not something that you can dip in and out of, because if you suddenly jerk up your oxalates, you can flare. So oxalates can clear from the body in fits and starts. And it's not uncommon for people to feel quite well in the first month after they reduce their oxalates. But then as the body starts to release more and more of the stored oxalates, this can trigger some flares. But as a whole, we want to notice that the body is functioning better. So for example, you may have a rash, but you're sleeping better. Your brain fog may be gone, but you know your gut is flaring a little bit. So sometimes one thing can get better, but another thing can get worse. But we just want to have that overall sense that as a whole, things are heading in the right direction. But it can sometimes look like one step forward, one step back. And it can be really hard to stick to the diet when you don't always know or feel that it's that you're making progress. And so although we don't necessarily want to encourage aggressive oxalate dumping, I often see these flares as a positive sign, because in my mind, if something is flaring, then it's an encouragement that there are oxalates there that need to get out of the system. We just have to go a little bit more slowly. And as time goes on, things will get easier. And so from personal experience, I share it's really important to make space in your life for the process, because there will be ups and downs. And if you're just trying to live your life without creating space for the emotional highs and lows, it's going to start to be very wearing physically and emotionally if you're just expecting to get on with things and not have to deal with anything. But as time goes on, you will feel more well, you will feel more stable, and this is what makes it worth it. And you may be able to reintroduce some higher oxalate foods into your diet, but the guidance is to stay around 150 milligrams of oxalates per day. That's 4 squares of dark chocolate. So it's not a lot, but that might be a good maintenance dose for someone who has been impacted by oxalate issues. Obviously, we also have to deal with the dysbiosis, the SIBO, the candida, the mold, the leaky gut, and all of those things as well. Otherwise, we may not be able to raise oxalates again. So I wanted to finish today with just a personal anecdote and just share some of my experience, because for me, oxalates were such a blind spot. As I said, I had high amounts of oxalobacter forma genes in my stool test. I had normal levels of urinary oxalates. There was nothing like there that screamed oxalates, at least to me. And one of the reasons I decided to give this a go was one of my lingering symptoms, which I can't remember if I've talked about on the podcast previously, is this post-exertional burning mouth. So I don't like people get post-exertional malaise, which is maybe like a flare in symptoms after some sort of physical activity, mental, emotional, physical. For me, after exercise, only intensive exercise, like walking, low intensity exercise, fine. But after high intensity exercise, like weight training, I would get this burning sensation, which sometimes would feel like it was in my gums. Sometimes it would feel like it was in my teeth. And more than anything else, it was just annoying. And I was just like, I really want to get rid of this. And given that oxalates can be associated with burning mouth, I went down this road, unknowing that it would reveal so much and I would learn as much as I did from it. And as I said already, like, love green tea, love dark chocolate, love almond butter on dark chocolate. So, you know, I have been fairly low carb, but I would sometimes have some sweet potato. You know, a lot of these high oxalate foods were my dietary staples. And so even though, as I've said, we need to do this slowly, gradually, I did not follow that advice, mostly because I thought, oh, my nut butter jar is finished now. I won't buy another one. I've run out of dark chocolate. I'm not going to buy another bar. And so unintentionally, I really reduced my oxalate intake quite quickly in a very short space of time, probably removing about, I don't know, like 100, 150 milligrams all in one go. And I broke out in hives. And I'm not somebody who gets things like itchy skin or eczema or any rashes or anything like that. But I broke out in a rash on my lower back and the backs of my knees, which was just mildly uncomfortable. And it did actually subside in a few days. And then about a month after that, I felt like amazing for the first month. And then I think possibly triggered by some hormonal fluctuation with my cycle, I had a new cycle start, and then the hives came back with like an absolute vengeance and got to the point where I couldn't sleep at night because I was so itchy, and I had to use steroid cream to control the itching. And yeah, basically it was just like another big dump that came, possibly due to some hormone fluctuations. I'm not quite sure. Then about a month after the hives, extreme hives issue, then I just had like a week of diarrhea of sandy stools. And sandy stools are typical of oxalates. So just like another clearing episode. So this is what I say about it wasn't fun. It just was not fun to be itching and running to the bathroom. But again, it's just that reassurance that I gave myself that this is all part of a cleansing process. This is part of a detoxification process. And it's so great that the stuff is getting out of your body. Obviously, if I was working with a client, I would not advise that they did it the way that I did it, but it's good to make mistakes and learn from them. So, you know, I was really skeptical that this was something that was an issue for me. And it's probably been one of the things that I've done that's been the most clearly an issue for me, just based on some of the experiences that I've had. So yeah, at the time of recording this, you know, I'm several months into the process. I will probably keep on going. I don't know for how long. I'll just feel into it a little bit more and track symptoms and whatnot. But it's been a very enlightening process. So that brings me to the end of today's episode. This has been a long one, so I hope you have enjoyed learning all about oxalates. Maybe it's given you an opportunity to think about some things in your own healing journey a little bit differently, maybe something to explore, and I hope you've got something from this episode, and I will see you in the next one.